I want to talk to you this morning about friendship. It's a word we're all familiar with, but it's an experience of which I suspect we're more ignorant than we think. What we call friendship these days is often just passing acquaintance, isn't it? A friend is a person who calls me by my Christian name and with whom I occasionally share a pint at the local or a coffee over the washing machine. Even at its very strongest, I suspect, friendship is likely these days to be little more than a synonym for comradeship. That esprit de corps you experience whenever you're thrown into close social contact with a group of your peers, like in a college or in the army. But neither neighbourliness nor camaraderie are, strictly speaking, to be identified with friendship, not in the narrow sense in which I want to talk about it this morning, anyway. A friend isn't just an acquaintance whom fate throws into my path and to whom sheer civility demands that I appear amicable. Neither is a friend just a comrade whom circumstances force me to live in close proximity to and with whom a certain degree of matiness almost inevitably develops as a result of our shared location. Now, true friendship is always something we elect to engage in. As the classicist Jacques Delisle once observed, God gives us relatives, thank God we can choose our friends. And that element of personal choice in friendship is fundamental to the nature of the relationship, if you think about it. It's for this reason that our friends do constitute a kind of character reference. A man is known by the company he keeps, we say, and it's fair comment, provided that company is composed of friends we have voluntarily selected, rather than just acquaintances or comrades with whom we couldn't avoid mixing except by being downright antisocial. One consequence of this element of choice, of course, is that friendship is a facet of human experience which we can, if we so desire, omit. Friendship is an optional extra in life. We're not forced to have friends. C.S. Lewis, in his outstanding essay on friendship in his book The Four Loves, brings this out very cogently. There is, as he puts it, an exquisite arbitrariness about friendship. I have no duty to be anyone's friend, and no man in the world has a duty to be mine. No claims, no shadow of necessity. Friendship is unnecessary, he says. Like philosophy. Like art. Friendship has no survival value. Rather, it is one of those things which gives value to survival. Indeed, according to Lewis, it's this quality of choice that distinguishes friendship not just from more superficial relationships like acquaintance and comradeship, but also those more intense and organic relationships born of blood kinship or sexual passion. There is no inevitability about friendship, as there is about genetic ties, he says. There's no urgency of desire about it, as there is in erotic love. And it's for precisely this reason, in his view, that friendship is, generally speaking, a rather marginal diversion in most people's lives today, rather than a centrally important feature of our social existence. We live, he says, in a culture that's preoccupied with intense feelings. And in that respect, the loves associated with family and sex have a clear advantage over friendship. Because there's altogether more animal instinct, more romance, more natural emotion tied up with them. Friendship, he says, has not enough tearful smiles and keepsakes and baby talk to please the sentimentalists of our 20th century. It looks thin and etiolated, a sort of vegetarian substitute for more red-blooded loves. Well, perhaps Lewis is right. Certainly, if we want to find times in history when friendship was more highly valued, we have to look back to periods when people were neither so obsessed with hearth and home as we are today, nor as obsessed with matters sexual. The era of medieval chivalry, for instance. You find friendship exalted there. In the great French chanson de geste, Roland and Oliver, Amis and Emile, friendship on the epic style, if you know those ballads. Or in the classical age of Greek and Latin literature, like Euripides' story of Orestes and Pylades, or Virgil's account of Nisus and Euryalus in the Aeneid. The novels and the plays of the 20th century really have nothing to compare with those, preoccupied as they are with Freud and the kitchen sink. Indeed, you know, the only books I could think of which, to my mind, really celebrate friendship in a major way are Three Men in a Boat and The Wind in the Willows. The one a comic farce and the other a children's fantasy. Well, enough said about 20th century attitudes towards friendship. Well, I want to suggest to you this morning that it is to our great loss that our contemporary culture has pushed friendship out onto the neglected margins of social experience in that way. For friendship, rightly understood and appreciated, is one of the most enriching and humanizing of all forms of love. Solomon, in his Proverbs, writes, "A man with many companions may come to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother." In other words, superficial acquaintances contribute very little to life. When it comes to friendship, quality rather than quantity is what counts, says Solomon. But when you do find real quality in a friend, you have found an experience of human intimacy and loyalty, which far from being inferior to those biological and instinctual ties of family devotion, is actually superior to them. "There is a friend who sticks closer than a brother," he says. And today in our studies in 1 Samuel, we are brought to a story of just one such relationship, David and Jonathan. A question, you see, you have to ask yourself when you come to chapters 18 and 19 and 20 of 1 Samuel is, why does the narrator devote so much space to the interaction between these two young men? After all, it contributes nothing very obvious to the theology of the book, nor does it add very significantly to the plot. The incidents recounted, for instance, in chapter 20, which we read, 42 verses of it, those incidents could have easily been told in the space of a couple of verses with no loss of important historical detail. So why does the author give this relationship between David and Jonathan such prominence in his narrative? Why does he include so much dialogue, so much detailing of trivial events between them? If you read some of the commentaries, you'll find that many of them dismiss these chapters as being rather insignificant, designed perhaps to defend the legitimacy of David's claim to the throne or to explain the background to some of his later actions in regard to the family of Saul, but really rather uninteresting in comparison with other parts of the book. Well, I have to say, that verdict merely proves to me how much some Old Testament scholars need to get their noses out of their Hebrew lexicons and into great literature. I want to suggest to you that what we have in these chapters is not a minor political tract or an interlude in some court diary. It's a sensitive and a poignant study in friendship. Every bit as sensitive and poignant as those classics from the pen of medieval and Greek and Latin authors that we've mentioned. In this part of 1 Samuel, God the Holy Spirit is not teaching, as he so often is, about God or the history of salvation. He's teaching us something about what it means to be human. He's turning that terse proverb of Solomon about the friend who sticks closer than the brother, he's turning it into a piece of living drama. And we must respond to it as we would to drama, not with the cold and cerebral detachment of a bored critic looking for theological purposes in the writer, but with the empathy and the emotional engagement of an involved audience looking for insight into our own feelings, into our own human experience. David and Jonathan is about us. It's about family tensions. It's about emotional conflicts. It's about friendships, what they could be, what they ought to be to us. And it is God's affirmation that these things are important to him, no less than our prayer life or our faith. That's how we're going to look at this story anyway this morning. As you see from the bulletin, we're going to look at it in two halves. First, we look at the nature of David and Jonathan's relationship. What made it so strong under the heading of a dangerous friendship? And then I want us to look at the tragic tangle of human emotions into which that relationship plunged them, under the heading, a conflict of loyalties. A dangerous friendship, first of all. And look back at the beginning of chapter 18. After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. He took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David. Now, what was at the root of this extraordinary fellow feeling that sprang up so suddenly between these two young men? Some people suggest it was Jonathan's esteem for David's military prowess. Jonathan, as we learn back in chapter 14, was no mean warrior himself. He'd engaged in a one-handed commando raid against the Philistine outpost, you remember, and won great honor for his valor. But of course, when it had come to Goliath of Gath, that story we were looking at last week in chapter 17, Jonathan had been as paralyzed with fear as everybody else in the Israelite camp, hadn't he? So the daring of this unarmed shepherd boy confronting the giant in the name of the God of Israel cannot but have impressed him. And the way the narrator attaches the relationship that sprang up between them to David's interview with Saul, which was the immediate sequel of that great victory, suggests that there was some admiration on Jonathan's part involved. On the other hand, others are strongly of the opinion that this friendship between David and Jonathan was politically motivated. They point out that phrases like covenant in verse 3 and loved him as himself, these phrases could be used in the ancient Near East as expressions of political alliance and feudal submission. One author even goes so far as to suggest that this exchange of clothes that we read about in verse 4 amounted to Jonathan's renunciation of his status as heir apparent. For the tunic and sword which he gave to David would have been royal insignia, and his removal of them in this way amounts to a kind of ceremonial abdication in David's favor. Still others, I suppose inevitably in these days we live in, regard the psychological roots of this friendship as homosexual. David, we are told in earlier chapters, was a good-looking youth with a fine physique. That famous nude study of the young David by Michelangelo that stands in Florence probably does him justice. And you don't need me to tell you how often reproductions of that particular work appear in the vestibules and doorways of gay clubs and pubs around this country. No doubt in the atmosphere of ancient Hebrew thought, they say, which was so hostile to homosexual practice, the erotic dimension of their relationship couldn't become explicit, but in reality, even unconsciously, they say, it was physical attraction that brought these two men together with such emotional intensity. Well, in response, I suppose we have to say that there may be shades of truth in all these things. But I also have to say I don't find any of them very convincing. I don't know if you do. Indeed, I suspect the theories tell us more about those theorists who voice them than they do about David and Jonathan. Frankly, anybody who can interpret the relationship we discover in these chapters and which we've just read about, anybody who can interpret that relationship as no more than professional admiration or political intrigue or repressed sodomy, frankly, they're merely proving to me how pathetically little they understand or have experienced themselves of real friendship. Of course Jonathan admired David's capability in single combat. Who wouldn't? And without mutual respect, friendship is impossible. But true friendship is far more than a tribute. Speak of it as mere admiration and you're confusing friendship with the fawning adulation of the sycophantic groupie. Of course Jonathan's commitment to David had important political consequences of which neither of them could have been ignorant. And it may well be that even at this early stage, Jonathan did recognize that it would be David who succeeded his father as king, not he himself. But true friendship can never be entered into as a mere stratagem. To speak of it as politically motivated is to vulgarize it to the level of a conspiracy. And of course Jonathan was not unaffected by David's handsome features. Nobody in Israel was impervious to his charm. Physical beauty is physical beauty, whatever its gender. And to suggest that its magnetism can only be felt by members of the opposite sex is just plain nonsense. But true friendship is never erotic in its motivation. Once it becomes so, it ceases to be friendship and has become something else. and to imply, as I'm afraid some people seem habitually to do these days, that a close one-to-one affinity between two men or two women must cross that erotic barrier and at least dormantly or unconsciously be homosexual in nature, is frankly to render the word friend at the very best shallow and at the worst degrading. In fact, you know, I do wonder myself if the fear of being thought gay hasn't done more than anything else in recent years to hinder the development of real friendships. We read at the end of chapter 20 that David and Jonathan wept in one another's arms and kissed. They could behave in that uninhibited way precisely because no dirty-minded little blackmailer was going to start spreading malicious rumors about them being a couple of queers. Homosexuality, you see, was not just an outrage in Hebrew society, it was quite literally unthinkable. So repugnant was it, it never occurred to anybody to suspect men and women of its practice. And for that reason, friendships between people of the same sex were liberated from this vicious innuendo of perversion and could express themselves with unashamed intimacy, as David and Jonathan do. I saw exactly the same thing in Africa. It was very common, you know, on the streets of Nairobi to see two young adult blacks walking hand in hand or embracing one another with great hugs of affection. If you'd seen that same behavior on the streets of London, you'd be quickly looking to see which earlobe the earring was in. But in Africa, such conclusions would have been utterly misplaced. Well, the truth is, you see, that our permissiveness towards homosexuality today does not actually enrich human relationships in our society at all. It impoverishes them by wrapping a cloud of sensual suspicion around perfectly innocent friendships. We need to realize, and perhaps we need to state more publicly than we have done, that God's law prohibits homosexual practice. It does not prohibit homosexual friendship. There is nothing in the Bible that suggests there is anything wicked or unsavory or effeminate about affectionate relationships between members of the same sex. There's not a hint that relationships of that kind are implicitly impure or unhealthy. No suggestion that those who engage in them are victims of abnormal sexual orientation. On the contrary, David and Jonathan are presented to us as a model of what real friendship can be. Mutual admiration, maybe. Mutual political interest, perhaps. Mutual affection, undoubtedly. But none of those things, either individually or together, explains this friendship. But the fact is, when it comes to friendship, there is something intangible about it. Something subtle. Something mysterious, something even magical, something which passes beyond the understanding of calculating minds, and certainly of dirty ones. I'm even tempted to call it something spiritual. Look at verse 1. Jonathan became one in spirit with David. When Aristotle asks, what is a friend? He answers it this way. A friend, he says, is a single soul dwelling in two bodies. It's that kind of spontaneous harmony that the narrator is describing here. Jonathan became one in spirit with David, or we might render the Hebrew literally, the soul of Jonathan was bound up with the soul of David. It's an exquisite idiom, powerfully conveying the inseparable devotion that united these two. They were, as we might say today, two hearts that beat as one. Two minds united by a single thought. That's the sort of trite cliche the 20th century has to offer instead of becoming one in spirit. But that unanimity is what always characterizes real friendship. They were on the same wavelength, we say. They're tuned into one another. Where that unison of soul comes from, no one, I think, can really analyze. To try to rationalize it is to devalue it. This sort of friendship happens. That's all you have the right to say. Every now and again, in the providence of God, someone crosses our path, perhaps as an acquaintance, perhaps as a comrade. But instead of remaining that, our spirits are united with them. A covenant is sealed. A love is kindled. An intermingling of identity takes place, an integration of soul, which is quite different from any other human relationship, and which, as the proverb says, transcends even that intimacy we share with our blood kin. There is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. Indeed, you know, David puts it in even more emotive terms. In his great lament in 2 Samuel 1, after the death of Jonathan, he writes these words: "I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love to me was wonderful. More wonderful than that of women." Our erotic 20th century put that in its pipe and smoke. And I hasten to say that comes from the lips of not of some effeminate pansy, but from a hero, a man's man, who in his time had 8 wives or more and innumerable concubines and sired 20 sons and no doubt an equivalent number of daughters. Now learn from David and Jonathan what a fine and noble and enriching thing friendship is. More reliable sometimes than family love. More satisfying sometimes than sexual love. Some of us here, I know, have had bad family backgrounds. You've been hurt by your families, rejected by them, alienated from them. When others go home in the vac, or you pay a visit to their family homes, you feel envious, resentful. Now you listen to me. Family is a blessing. God knows it is a blessing. But sometimes, friendship can be a greater blessing than family. Some of us here are, frankly, sexually frustrated. Our marriages are broken up. Our fiancés have jilted us. We don't seem to be able to form relationships with the opposite sex very easily. We have a nagging fear we're going to remain single all our lives. Now you listen to me. Marriage is a blessing. God knows it is a blessing. But sometimes friendship is a greater blessing than marriage. True, friendship is not written in your DNA or driven by your hormones. Friendship is something you must choose to enter. Neither heredity nor passion is going to compel you into it. But friendship is not to be despised for that. There's nothing tepid or ephemeral about real friendship. You find it, and you may well consider at the end of the day that you have been more blessed in it than many whose families and girlfriends and marriages you now envy. That's the first lesson I want you to think about from our passage this morning. But, and here we have to be perfectly candid, friendship is a dangerous thing. For friendship creates a social bond which threatens other bonds. Sometimes the emotional tension that results from an antagonism because of a friendship can be tragic and bitter. And it was so for David and Jonathan. Theirs was a dangerous friendship. And that brings us to the second thing I want us to look at their story at. As a conflict of loyalties. Look on to chapter 19. Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David, but Jonathan was very fond of David and warned him. Of course, the story of Saul's insane jealousy towards David is a sobering lesson in its own right, isn't it? Sown as it was just as a seed of thought by the tactlessness of those women, attributing thousands to Saul, but tens of thousands to David in their song. What a silly song it was. And a bigger man would have shrugged it off. But in Saul it grew and grew, feeding on his own insecurity, fueled by every military success David won, till eventually it became a morbid, homicidal obsession. You do well to remember that advice given to Othello. "Oh, beware, my lord, of jealousy. It is the green-eyed monster which doth mock the meat it feeds on." But of course, for poor Jonathan, this psychopathic paranoia on Saul's part generated a huge personal dilemma too, for he was David's friend. But he was also Saul's eldest son. How on earth could he resolve the conflict of loyalty implicit in those two relationships? Well, there was really only two possible solutions. And they're both illustrated in the story. The first solution was reconciliation. We see him trying that in verses 4 and 5 of 19. Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, "Let not the king do wrong to his servant David. He hasn't wronged you. What he's done has benefited you." What a super thing it is when we're able to use our influence to heal the enmity and soften the hatred between people in this world. "Blessed are the peacemakers," said Jesus. How many of them we need? You know, there's a story told of Admiral Lord Nelson just before the Battle of Trafalgar, how he discovered that one of his junior admirals, Collingwood, was not on good terms with the Captain Rotherham. So he sent a boat to fetch the two of them. And when they stood in front of him on the bridge, he put their hands together and he pointed to the French fleet on the horizon and he said, "Look, yonder is the enemy." Jonathan is performing an act of mediation just as wise here. "Look," he's saying to his father, "yonder in the Philistine encampments is the enemy. David has done a great job fighting them on your behalf. He's not your foe. He's even risked his life to deliver you from them. And you've been glad enough to celebrate his victories. Can't you see then how unjust it is to plot his execution when the only evidence of sedition against him is his popularity with the people?" It's a masterpiece, this, of ironical diplomacy. And its simple appeal to fair play is not without its effect. You see, you can even appeal to fair play of the souls of this world. Worth remembering that. Saul listened to Jonathan, verse 6, and took this oath, "As surely as the Lord lives, David will not be put to death." So Jonathan called David and told him the whole conversation and brought him to Saul, and David was with Saul as before. That type of conciliatory exercise must always be our first response in a situation of conflict of loyalty. We must destroy enemies by making them friends. How different the rest of 1 Samuel might have read if this détente between David and Saul had been maintained. But unfortunately, Saul's moment of lucid rationality and fairness was all too brief. Another military campaign, another outstanding victory by David, another black mood upon Saul, and the old homicidal jealousy sweeps back with a vengeance. An evil spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he's sitting in his house. While David was playing the harp, Saul tried to pin him to the wall with his spear. Not hard to imagine the agony into which this new rift plunged poor Jonathan. Indeed, at first, he seems to find it hard to believe that relationships have broken down again quite so badly. At the beginning of chapter 20, verse 2, "You're not going to die. Look, my father doesn't do anything great or small without confiding in me. Why would he hide this from me? It's not so." As David is quick to point out, insane though Saul is, he is not without cunning. The friendship of Prince Jonathan and General David was now common knowledge at court, and Saul would not again risk confiding his true intentions to his son anymore. "Your father knows very well that I found favor in your eyes. He has said to himself, 'Jonathan must not know this, or he will be grieved.'" Notice the discretion of that. He doesn't say, "Jonathan must not know this, or he will give the game away." He will be grieved. David sensitively refuses to drive a greater wedge of distrust between Saul and his son than was absolutely necessary. A lesson intact we could all learn when talking about our in-laws to our partners. But of course, no matter how tactful David is, and he has a great gift for rhetoric, as we know, nobody can hide the drama of the situation that follows. It's full of emotional intensity. David, with characteristic eloquence, presents Jonathan with the choice that he is forced to make between his friendship and his family. Look at verse 8. "As for you, show kindness to your servant, for you have brought him into covenant with you before the Lord. If I'm guilty, kill me yourself. Why hand me over to your father?" Jonathan's response is emphatic. He would be true to David even if he meant betraying his father's intentions to David, just as he'd done before. Never, Jonathan said. If I had the least inkling my father was determined to harm you, I would tell you, he said. But David doesn't trust Saul to tell Jonathan. That's the problem. So they devise this subtle ploy. I'll stay away from the big banquet tomorrow. You know how that'll get under Saul's skin. With any luck, the mask of benevolence he wears just to convince you, Jonathan, that he's got no malicious intent toward me will be dissolved. And his frayed temper will appear and you will see exactly what his real mood is. And then we shall know. So Jonathan agrees and devises this code of signals to communicate to David what he finds out. And unfortunately, David's suspicions are all too quickly proven justified, aren't they? Verse 27. Saul said to his son Jonathan, why hasn't the son of Jesse, there's contempt even in that, isn't there? Why hasn't the son of Jesse come to the meal either yesterday or today? Jonathan answered, David earnestly asked me permission to go to Bethlehem. Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse and rebellious woman. You know what the English equivalent of that is, don't you? Don't I know that you've sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. See the irony in these words. For Saul was right. Jonathan had just as much to lose through David's growing power in the land, as his father did. The difference was that Jonathan was willing to let David be king. Saul was not that humble any longer. In vain, Jonathan tries to play the role of mediator again, but this time Saul's hatred is implacable. Why should he be put to death? What's he done? Saul hurls his spear at him to kill him. Gets up from the table in fierce anger, grieved at his father's shameful treatment. Now, I want you, if you haven't done already, to put yourself into Jonathan's shoes. Feel it with him. What would you have done? Remember, your father has just insulted a personal friend who means the world to you. He's given clear notice that he intends to murder him at the first opportunity. As if to confirm his intention, he's thrown the bread knife at you across the dinner table and in front of a lot of friends, publicly. You are fuming with indignation. You stamp out of the room, slamming the door behind you in your rage and humiliation. Now what do you do? Just think about what Jonathan did. Look at verse 41. David got up from the south side of the stone and bowed down before Jonathan three times with his face to the ground. Then they kissed each other and wept together. But David wept the most. See, when reconciliation fails, the only solution remaining in a situation of conflict of loyalties is separation. You cannot permanently exist in a state of divided allegiance. It's like that punishment they used to inflict on criminals, you know, bending two saplings over and tying the victim to both, so that when the sapling sprang back like a catapult to the vertical, he was literally torn limb from limb. So Jonathan was in danger of being emotionally bisected, torn asunder by these rival affections. Reconciliation had failed. Separation was now the only answer. But separation from whom? That's the question, isn't it? It was a bitter and agonizing choice. These tears and kisses bespeak a brokenness of heart as intense as anything you or I will ever experience in life. But in the end, his choice is made. Go in peace. We have sworn friendship. The Lord is witness between us. Then David left, and Jonathan went back to the town. Is that what you'd have done? No, you'd have gone with David, wouldn't you? That's what happens in all the cowboy stories.
We'd have gone into exile, the royal prince and the popular hero. It would have been an invincible alliance. Saul couldn't have stood a chance. The civil war would have been over in months, wouldn't it? Would it? Who can say whether it would or it wouldn't? What we do know is that ultimately, this parting from David in order to remain with Saul cost Jonathan not just his political career, it cost him his life. A few years later, he died in battle with his two brothers and his father beside him. How are the mighty fallen? David sang when he heard the news. Saul and Jonathan. Saul and Jonathan. In life they were loved and gracious. And in death they were not parted. Now a parting there had been. But it was David and Jonathan who had parted. Not Saul and Jonathan. For those of us who know the end of the story, the pathos of this separation at the end of chapter 20 is agonizing. And all the more agonizing, I think, because the narrator records it in such an offhand and casual way. David left, and Jonathan went back to the town. Well, was it a mistake? Should he have stayed with David? Was his decision to go back to the town a weak-kneed refusal to follow his heart? The narrator doesn't direct us on the point, does he? He refuses to moralize. He leaves us instead to meditate on the tragedy of the situation and to draw our own conclusions. You may feel Jonathan was wrong. But for myself, I have to say, I am filled with admiration for that decision. See, Jonathan here is setting us a most moving example of the way that sometimes, when loyalties conflict and separation is inevitable, sometimes in that situation, the path of personal duty does not coincide with the path of personal preference or of personal advantage. Sometimes in this world, the right choice is not the one that leads to the maximization of our fulfillment or our happiness. It is rather the one that leads to self-sacrifice and sorrow. And particularly is that true in the area of friendships. Friendships are things we have to learn to lose sometimes. For the sake of obligations which we are morally bound to by the law of God. Obligations like honor your father and your mother. It all comes back to that observation we made right at the beginning. Friendship is an optional extra. We voluntarily enter friendship in life. But family is different. Family ties are built into the structure of our existence, whether we like it or not. God did give us relatives. Choice makes our friends. Jonathan's refusal here to assert his individual right to choose his own friends in defiance of his filial responsibility to support his father. Some of you may call that cowardly. As I thought about it this week, it has come home to me just how courageous a decision that was. Listen. Some of us here are in the midst of conflict of loyalty problems, aren't we? They're not unusual. They're legion. The daughter brings home her boyfriend. You're not bringing that lad into my home again, says Dad. A conflict of loyalty. The husband takes his wife to dinner with his colleague from work. We're not going there again. His wife is an utter cat. Conflict of loyalty. Most difficult of all. The boy who is converted at the local youth club. I'm not having you get all religious, says his mother. I forbid you to go to that church again. It's a conflict of loyalty. How do we handle rival claims upon our commitment like that? I suggest to you, Jonathan shows us the way. The first thing we do is to try by every means possible to find a path of reconciliation. That needs tact and patience and planning on our part, and it may very well be very difficult. It will certainly need us to be prepared to act as mediators. But we must not jump to the conclusion that the situation is hopeless prematurely. Perhaps when Dad gets to know the boyfriend, he will like him better. Perhaps when the wife meets your colleague's missus again, she will revise her judgment about her. Perhaps if Mum actually meets some of those church folks, she'll become a Christian herself. That must be our best hope, and until we have exhausted the possibilities of such reconciliation, we must not think of any more drastic action, as Jonathan did not. We must not make mountains out of molehills in our human relationship. But, and the issue must be faced, if a conflict of loyalties cannot be reconciled in that kind of happy way, then the situation can escalate to the point where separation is the only option left you. And there you face the agony Jonathan did. Which side of the emotional partition are you going to stand on? That is a moral question, as well as a question of heart. You may disagree with the implications of the advice I'm about to give you, but I believe the story of David and Jonathan illustrates moral principles in that kind of decision. The two principles I recommend to you are these. First, that we must recognize that the right path may well be a costly one for ourselves. I have little doubt that Jonathan's heart would have preferred to go with David. But the right choice is not always the preferred choice. And secondly, in those sort of situations, we have to recognize that there is a scale of priorities in human relationships which must be respected when a conflict of loyalty occurs. At the head of that scale of priorities is God. No relationship can ever be allowed to compromise our allegiance to Him. That's why Jesus said, "A man's foes shall be those members of his own house." Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Take up your cross. For some of us, the penalty of choosing Jesus is alienation in our families. But that is the right choice. Precisely because God has the right to come at the top of the list of our relational priorities. Below God in that list of priorities comes our parental family. Honor your father and your mother, says the command, that it may go well with you. And the apostle tells us that that command amounts to obedience in childhood, for sure. Neither is it conditional upon our parents treating us well or our feeling great affection for them. It's a moral duty. Between that loyalty to parents and to God, the Bible only inserts one category of relationship: the marital family. For this reason, says the scripture, a man leaves his father and mother and is joined to his wife, and the two become one flesh. So that when we marry, we receive a new next of kin, and our parents take second place to the one with whom we are joined in any conflict situation with in-laws. That is the principle that has to be applied. So there is God, there is our marital family, there is a parental family. But I am suggesting you that friendship comes forth. Though in terms of emotional commitment, they may be, as we've said, more important to us than either marriage or family, yet in situations of a conflict of loyalty, they will often be the relationships we are to sacrifice. That is what Jonathan shows us here. For as Lewis said, no one has a duty to be my friend, nor do I have a duty to be anybody else's friend. Friendship is a choice I make, not a moral obligation. And being a choice, it can be unmade in a way that moral obligations cannot. So there I suggest you is our priority list. God first, marital family second, parental family third, personal friendships fourth. I don't say that's a rule of thumb that will solve all your problems. Where does a fiancé figure? Where does a stepmother figure? As in all decisions of life, we need the direction of the Holy Spirit to sensitize us to the particularities of the problem we're in. And we will often be bewildered by conflict of loyalty problems, in spite of that general guidance that we can find. But Jonathan's decision, in my view, was the right one. And it may be that some of us need to make equally painful decisions in terms of relationships. For most of us, this heart-rending parting of David and Jonathan will find an echo, if not already in our experience, if not now, then one day. Because this kind of parting of friends is part of human love. It is part of friendship. And the Bible here is showing it to us. It will not hide it from us. How do we cope with heartbreak like that? How did Jonathan cope? How did he sleep that night or the next night? Where did he find the emotional strength to go on living in spite of this bitter sense of loss he'd suffered? The narrator gives us just one clue. Turn over to chapter 23 and verse 16. As far as we know, there's only one occasion when David and Jonathan met again between this parting and that fearful battle in which Jonathan died. And it was a brief meeting at that. David, a fugitive in the hills, pursued remorselessly by the murderous malice of Saul, is getting wearier and wearier of his loneliness. And we read in verse 16 of chapter 23, Saul's son Jonathan went to David and helped him find strength in God. It's a beautiful little verse, that, isn't it? You can miss it so easily. But you see, it throws open a window on the relationship of these two men we haven't previously seen. Jonathan was a man of faith, a real personal faith, as David had. We might have guessed it because only a believer can really understand and sympathize with another believer's heart. Jonathan and David were not just one in spirit, they were one in spirituality. You may be sure if Jonathan was able to encourage David in his loneliness to find strength in God, that's exactly where Jonathan himself found the strength to cope with that cruel separation that duty to his father had pressed upon him. Now listen. Maybe this morning you feel lonely. Maybe you've lost a friend. Or maybe you feel you've never had a friend. Like Jonathan, you feel deserted, cheated of that affection and companionship that would enrich your life so much. Jonathan helped David to find strength in God at that situation. Will you let me perform the same service for you? And let me introduce you to a friend before you go this morning? A friend who, unlike other friends, knows the worst about you and loves you just the same. Most of all, a friend for whom no conflict of loyalties need ever separate you from. Indeed, never, nor ever can separate you from. Jesus said, greater love has no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. And you are mine. God sometimes does bring tragedy into our lives. It's no good pretending he doesn't. It's no good fuming with resentment when he does. Sometimes we do have to sacrifice relationships that are immensely precious to us. But be sure of this. He offers us in exchange something infinitely sweeter and more fulfilling than any friendship this world can offer. He offers us himself. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Asks the apostle. Shall trouble, hardship, persecution, famine, nakedness, sword? No, in all these things we are more than conquerors For I am convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future nor any powers, neither height nor depth nor anything else in all creation will ever be able to separate us from the love of God which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. Life may part you from your David, but it